This episode of AVXL was recorded on March 23rd, 2018. We're going to talk bias sliding, subwoofer chuffing, Rob's got new calibration and testing gear on the way, LG's B7 OLED, killer price, and hey, let's hang out at CanJam LA.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right, I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater and audio gear, no matter what your budget is. We love screens, projectors, televisions, speakers, bookshelf speakers, floor standing speakers, headphones, DACs, amps.
Lighting.
Lighting. Bias lighting.
You got it.
Room tuning.
Indeed. Treatments.
Treatments.
Oh, pixels. My goodness. All of it.
It is a glorious Friday morning here in Northern California. It stopped raining, so Robert and I look more cheerful than we have, I think.
There is actual sunshine outside.
It's weird, man.
It's kind of nice.
It is kind of nice.
Although it was good rain. We needed it. Probably gave some snow up in the mountains.
Oh, my goodness.
Or provided or produced, so to speak.
So to speak. Well, you know, it's good because the more rain we get at this time of year, the less likely we are to be not flushing the toilets this summer because of a drought.
Oh,
that was almost a sentence in a perfect order. Technically, by the way, this is not a weather podcast between two middle-aged guys talking about sunshine. It is actually, again, AVXL, home video and audio gear. And
yes.
It's exciting. I got some headphones I'm not going to talk about till next week.
Okay.
Well, one more is triple driver over ear.
Yeah. I saw them. I haven't heard them.
Well, I got to say, I saw the announcement and I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
Multiple drivers in a headphone.
Probably at a great
price. Usually when you have multiple drivers in a headphone, it's either staggeringly expensive or it's a gimmick. These are not a gimmick. They are very interesting.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I look forward.
I'm going to try to sneak that review. I can't decide if I want to sneak that review out before CanJam or listen to a bunch more stuff at CanJam or just do all of the above.
Yeah.
In any case, CanJam
exactly.
LA, CanJam Southern California coming up first week in April. If you're going to be in Southern California, I'm thinking about doing a hangout.
Is that open to the public?
Well, yeah, you got to pay like $20.
Oh, that's nice.
It is nice.
No press credentials required.
No, it is for headphone enthusiasts. It's put together by HeadFi. It's kind of like, you know, it is the HeadFi community. They do one at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest in October. There's one coming up in Singapore, I want to say this weekend.
If you are a fan of cans, I think CanJam would be the place to go, especially if you're in Southern California.
Well, if you want to, what's amazing, right, is they will typically have everything from like one more with incredibly affordable stuff to those $4,000, you know, Focal headphones and everything in between. Mr. Speakers,
that's cool.
Which you've heard me talk about a lot, but you probably can't find Mr. Speakers in your neighborhood. Case, it's a wonderful way to get out and try a whole bunch of gear that you might normally not be able to afford or even be able to find the opportunity to listen to. I highly recommend it.
Is it just usually one day or is it going for a couple of days?
Two days.
Nice way to spend the weekend.
Well, yeah. I just got to get down there.
Got
to get all the family healthy so I can haul myself to Los Angeles. You got new calibration gear coming.
Yeah. I am... staring at the tracking numbers. It should be in my hands before this evening, and I am really looking forward to it. I have a new meter and a new signal generator. And the nice thing about the meter is that it's rated up to 10,000 nits.
Whoa.
And it's much faster. So in terms of taking readings, I'm really looking forward to putting that through the paces. And the signal generator is just compatible with all the formats I use. I have another signal generator already that's really good, but this one adds a few new features, and the price was right on it. And I'm also testing out a new version of the awesome Calman software from the good folks at Portrait Displays and SpectraCal that I am going to be diving into. It has some updated features regarding the new auto calibration technologies that are being built into some new TVs nowadays, including Samsung and LG. And I am looking forward to putting that through its paces as well. And I have to also mention, man, that $1,500 price point on the 55-inch 2017 LG B7A OLED is really tempting me. I need one of those, actually. The 2018 TVs, I've worked on quite a few of the 2017 ones as well, but the 2018 ones have some solid features I need to experiment with as well, but... Mm-hmm. That 2017 B7 is something that it's nice to have one around to try various things in terms of either calibration setup and also how you apply certain settings, and just to have it to work on at whim. For the 55-inch screen at that price point, I don't think it's going to get much lower, considering that the 2018 models are very close to being available.
It would seem kind of pointless with the 2018 models coming as fast as they are.
But they will be more expensive than this for quite a while. So I would either have to wait for the price to drop significantly or pull the trigger right now on that 55-inch that's currently on sale for $1,500 with free delivery. I'll weigh my options there. Oh, on the last episode, I also mentioned the new Sonys that are coming out. There's a lot of them, including their new OLED and other premium panels as well, but their X850F and the X900F we talked about in terms of size and availability, they are shipping now. What I didn't really realize was that they're both direct lit LCDs. They use an array of LEDs behind the screen to provide illumination. And it turns out that the X900F also incorporates full array local dimming. And I find that just to be fantastic, man. Considering it's likely brighter than last year's, and I would assume the color performance probably got a slight bump up as well in terms of how saturated it can produce its various shades that appear on the screen.
So many shades.
I'm really looking forward to checking that out, especially with the local dimming available in. It's still in the XBR line, so it's still what they consider a premium TV, but this is at like the most affordable of their premium TVs, so to speak.
So to speak.
The other kind of surprise, too, is the fact that they're offering 49-inch to 85-inch screen sizes. Wow. This crop of like 83, 85-inch screens, we saw similar things at CES last year, but it was rare to actually ever see those out in the wild. It's like, okay, we did announce a particular large, like over 70-inch screen size, 80-something, but you really never saw them very much. But at least for the LCD manufacturers across the board, they seem to be offering sizes well into the 80-inch range now, and they look to be shipping now, and that's great. If you're curious, the 85-inch Sony X900F for a cool $5,300 on Amazon right now. Still, it's like that might sound expensive, but it should offer fantastic quality. I'll be curious to also see if there are any more zones on the larger sized screens. Usually the amount of zones of local dimming scale with actual screen size. So usually on the smaller screens, you might have a few less zones. And just by the nature of it, when you increase the screen size up to 85 inches, that usually incorporates more local dimming in terms of zones that can be individually controlled, which should help not only make things like the letterboxed bars on your favorite movies look better or darker, but it also should improve overall contrast within pictures as well. I'm a big fan of LCDs that incorporate full array local dimming. And it's usually not something, I mean, I guess you could say Vizio kind of pioneered the whole, let's just put it in everything, and they're known for good value already. So I like to see other companies also adopting that technology, and it's there. And I love it. And I think it's really nice. Speaking of LCDs.
Oh my goodness. We got a pile of questions we've
been
building on. Let's start off with something we haven't done a whole lot of talking about. Bias lighting. Which I think achieved its sort of non-DIY hackery peak with a Philips Ambilight.
Oh, yeah, totally. We had a viewer named Bill send in an email question about this. He had been using an LCD TV for years, and he used strips of white LEDs around the back of the LCD to help improve how the picture looks, especially in dark room environments. And he has since upgraded to very good-looking plasmas, and he didn't feel the need was as great.
Right.
And he was kind of wondering, hey, should I use them anyway? Is there a benefit, even on a display that might not need them? So first, yeah, what is bias lighting? It's effectively placing a light source behind the TV. Mm-hmm. And the number one use I see for it, at least in the pro environments, is reducing eye strain. And yeah. I think that applies to anybody. If you're looking at a very bright screen overall in a very dark room, that can work your eyes a little harder than you probably want it to.
Yeah,
so.
And it's funny because I mentioned Philips with the Ambilight was one of the first ones to do this, where it would take advantage of, you know, I want to say LEDs.
Oh,
I
assume they were
LED, and they, you used, know, yeah, you, it would analyze what was going on the screen. It would create backlighting that would complement, right? Because when you look at a screen, there's normally, especially in a dark room, you have a dark room,
and your eyes, you know, dilate your pupils for a dark room. And then you look at the television and the television is super, super bright. And there's a relatively painful transition.
Yeah.
Because for some reason, it's difficult for most people to stare at the direct center of a television for the duration of an entire program.
Stare at the sun.
No. So by putting lighting behind the panel, just doing any kind of soft lighting, you know, up to a certain level will create a transitional effect, a gray zone, if you will, between the dark of the room and the brightness of the panel. But Ambilight took it to the next step, which was to analyze what was going on the screen and create complementary lighting of a particular color.
Cool visual effect, by the way.
Yes.
So say there's like an orangey sunset happening on the screen, you would get like an orangey colored backlight system. Mm-hmm. And I believe they also had it where you could control it to whatever color you liked. A bias lighting system would be a way to add light to a room without it being visually distracting.
Right.
And beyond that, when I say that it does truly enhance picture contrast, mm-hmm. how it appears to your eye, especially on TVs that had less than perfect black level, where, you know, maybe when you sat in a pitch black room and you're watching a letterbox movie,
yeah.
you would notice that those letterboxes weren't really black. They were, you know, some glowing shade of gray, depending on the quality and how much you spent on that TV.
It's pretty funny because Logitech, for example, has just come out. They haven't started shipping yet. It's going to be a while, but they have these new LightSync PC gaming speakers, which include LED lights in the back of the speakers. And
oh, crazy.
Their software analyzes what's going on in the game. So it creates, there's this shot they have of Battlefield on a screen, and there's a flamethrower on the right half of the screen and sort of a dark blue, you know, descending sun, you know, the sun is setting, kind of dark blue sky on the left side. So, and there's this gradient in between the two speakers. People have done these with Raspberry Pis.
Yes,
with the lighting.
With dynamic RGB. And those look fantastic as well. I actually use a quote unquote D65 optimized bias light from Media Light on one of the TVs I have. And it is convenient. It runs off of one of the TV's USB ports. They include a wall adapter too. Mm-hmm. It's just simple. Stick it right to the back and it provides a glow from behind the screen. So even when I'm sitting in a pitch black room, I am less inclined to say adjust the backlight setting on the TV to reduce it in a darkroom environment versus daytime when I crank it up. By having that bit of bias lighting, it takes away that harsh transition we were talking about, especially when viewing in a dark room. Mm-hmm. And as far as enhancing the picture quality of, I hate to say lesser, but TVs that can't do that perfect black, mm-hmm. it really does make a difference.
Basically anything other than...
Because it's ruining your perception of right. fine dark detail or elevating the darkest black you can see, but it helps the TV look better.
By surrounding the screen with a little bit of light, you make the grayest blacks on the screen
look
blacker because they are surrounded by brighter light. It's weird, but it works, right?
And I mentioned too, this is technology used in pro environments as well.
Yeah.
One thing I did run into with something like a D65, which refers to a particular mm-hmm. shade of white or a hue of white you can think of. It's supposed to be fairly neutral. It's supposed to represent how sunlight would appear on an overcast day at noon. It's supposed to be a neutral shade of gray.
Right.
Now, if you're going to use a bias lighting system on a painted wall, this is where it runs into issues. In one room, I have these orange-colored walls. So when I put the D65 light behind the screen, effectively, I'm creating some weird shade of something. It's not quite the orange of the wall anymore, and it's definitely not D65 white anymore. While it would be nice to have a wall that's neutral gray and then use this D65 light, you mentioned Ambilight and DIY projects using Raspberry Pi. I find even a roll of affordable RGB LED mm-hmm. tape is a handy option for being able to fine-tune that color output so that the light is either more neutral or more artistic, or it gives you some control then over how it's going to look in a variety of environments. And it's a good way to go. I'm seeing, and we mentioned monitors, seeing at CES, I saw several name brand monitors that were incorporating bias lighting built into them. So in terms of when you're gaming away, it provided a nice color splash behind the screen. Now, this really does require either a wall-mounted TV or a TV placed very close to the wall in order to really take advantage of these effects. So if you don't have that set up, then this is probably less of an issue, but I'm a big fan of it. I think it works really well, and
the stuff you...
in the right environment, so or the right configuration in terms of how the TV's set up in a room, but...
you're using the stuff that Joe Kane came up with, or Joe Kane helped develop, which is MediaLite. It's $50, gets powered off the USB port on the TV.
Like, I recently was visiting with a professional colorist for Hollywood movies and things like that. This room happened to have a neutral gray wall and then a D65 bias light behind the main display they were using. That made perfect sense. But like I said, if you're dealing with households like mine where every room is a different color and sometimes and nothing is a nice neutral shade of gray, which I imagine, unless it's like plain drywall or something, I think most houses are probably dealing with that. So that's just something to keep in mind if you're shopping for this kind of stuff.
So getting back to Bill's question specifically, he's got a Panasonic Viera.
Very good black levels.
Very good black levels.
Yeah.
Is it going to help make them look blacker, or is he pretty much...
would, actually.
Because OLED is going to be like the ultimate black.
It would make the apparent contrast look better, but it also, you know, it depends more. How is the room lighting in the room already? Are you normally watching that TV with fairly aggressive settings in terms of getting light output out of it? And in a pitch black environment, it would help reduce eye strain.
Right.
Or if you needed an additional light in that room.
Let me say, help reduce eye strain, not produce. If you watch in a bright room, there is no point to having bias lighting because the room is already brightly lit.
True.
If you watch in a very, very dark room, and the darker the room, the more dramatic the impact is going to be, bias lighting will be helpful. Particular color temperature of light?
That's the thing. The light has to reflect off of something. So you're assuming the TV is placed near a wall or wall mounted.
And the wall is white.
Yeah, and if it's not a neutral color already, sure, you can use any color. You could, I'm not going to say any color light, but going with something very neutral may not produce that neutral color you're looking for. And
because the wall is not a neutral color.
It's going to reflect whatever color that wall is. So that's just something to keep in mind. But maybe you have an older LCD, like from a few years ago, and contrast performance had a lot to be desired. This is something you could do rather easily that would definitely improve the visual quality of that display.
Quick thought on color temperature. The MediaLite Joe Kane worked on, they are using a 6500K correlated color temperature on that one with a CRI of 90+, which means the colors it renders are particularly accurate.
Yep.
Or it's particularly good light in terms of...
It makes my orange wall look perfect.
Perfectly orange.
Perfectly orange.
Will it also work behind a projection screen?
You know, actually, as long as there's a gap between the screen and the wall. Now,
You mean space behind the screen?
Yes. Right. I was actually looking at a screen last night in a commercial setup where the mount was spaced from the wall by at least an inch or two. Mm-hmm. And then they, for artistic purposes, put a nice string of a blue LED tape. Or probably RGB LEDs, but it was a very beautiful blue that they had around the whole edge of the screen. And this was a pretty bright environment as well.
Right.
I don't know if I'd call that necessarily done for pure bias lighting effects to improve picture quality as much as it was, it looked cool.
Right.
It was just a cool looking setup. It didn't take away from the picture quality. And it's ideal in a sense if you're going to add lighting to a room with projection screens in them because the light is behind the screen. So it's definitely not going to fall directly on the screen, which would definitely be something you don't want in terms of it.
You never want light between, you never want light. Yeah, even with my radically improved projector, it's amazing how much better the color, I want to say saturation and the blacks get. The darker the room gets.
Night and day.
You know, I mean, I used to be able to not see my screen at all if a window was open. Now I can see the screen, but I immediately go up and close the curtains.
And that's why the current trend with flat panel TVs, LCDs and OLEDs, the anti-reflective coating on the front of these, they are pushing that as hard as anything in terms of making that better and better every year for that very reason. Especially in a well-lit room, the less that screen reflects, the more light you're going to perceive, the brighter the picture will appear, and it will appear less washed out. There are advantages to that as well, I should say.
Oh my goodness.
I like bias lighting. It's handy in certain specific applications and even in projection setups. So
even in projection.
And if you had like a hung screen too or a roll-up screen, those generally aren't flat against the wall. So that might be more challenging if it's constantly rolling up and down because then you might reveal your bias lighting if you have it mounted on the wall itself. Anyway, consider your options. Add some LEDs.
But the short answer is yes.
Yeah.
It will help you, even with the extraordinary blacks.
And I mean, of that you could television. Start with any kind of light source. Put a flashlight behind it just to get an idea of what the addition of light behind the screen can do for picture quality. It's worth experimenting with.
Absolutely.
Save your eyes.
Or at least make your...
More contrast.
Inkier.
Yep. make your not-so-dark grays or black levels look way darker.
This is kind of a classic entry-level audio product kind of question, although it can happen to any subwoofer that is pushed to its illogical extreme. Rocco writes in, I'm a big fan of the show and have been following since the days of HD Nation. Thank you, Rocco. Ooh. I'm pleased that the podcast has been a success. Thank you. So are we. I have a question about optimizing my 5.1 home theater subwoofer. I have an Energy Take Classic speaker set and recently have been trying to squeeze a little more bass out of the system. I have my crossover set to 110 hertz in the receiver, level at 0 dB. I then use the knob on the back of the sub to adjust to a comfortable listening level. I recently noticed that during major action scenes, like the Iron Man Hulk fight scene in Avengers Age of Ultron, my sub makes chuffing or port noise from too much airflow escaping the sub. This only occurs during extremely low frequency scenes and at higher volumes. Is there a way to fix this occurrence without upgrading to a larger sub? Thanks again for all the information you guys provide. Sincerely, Rocco. First up, you're welcome.
Yeah. It's so funny. I have that very set of speakers. I just realized sitting in my storage. Mm-hmm. I probably should do something with them.
You should.
Give them away or sell them or do something.
You know, those were amazing speakers when they came out.
Yep.
It's probably 15 years ago now.
But it's like, I just realized, it's like, oh, there's another product sitting in my storage. It's like, do something with that.
Well, you moved
Let somebody else enjoy it.
You
who
moved
can use
into
it.
A room with a considerably different sound system.
Oh, no, yeah, I ain't doing anything here. But, like, maybe, you know what, I keep them around because I might need it for a lab setup or something. It's just, it's a known quantity I can experiment with, yeah.
That's a tough set of speakers, right? Normally, you go in your receiver, you set your speakers to small. The crossover is probably going to be at 80 hertz at that point. Energy says, if possible, to set the crossover frequency to 100 to 120 hertz. And the reason they do that is because those speakers, the 5 and the 5.1 of that set of speakers, they fall off a cliff somewhere around, let's call it 110 hertz. Yeah. they have almost no low end, which means all the low end has to go through the subwoofer. Which is not necessarily a bad thing. But as you noted, Rocco, chuffing or farting noises, it's also described as whooshing, humming. That's turbulence, right? And as the air moves in and out of the port tube on a subwoofer. And essentially, in theory, any subwoofer, although you tend to find it's more common with less expensive subwoofers, once the airflow exceeds a certain speed or velocity, which tends to be concentrated around the tuning point, the frequency in hertz of that tube, you get chuff. And it almost always happens on big low-end bass and explosion stuff like you noticed. Some folks have had success experimenting with the room placement of their subwoofer, that by optimizing the location of the subwoofer, they were able to reduce the volume the subwoofer was set at. Basically, to create a louder sound, a subwoofer has to move more air. And to move more air, it has to work harder. Right. Or, by moving more air, that's when you get to the point where you hit the turbulence level because it's trying so hard and it's moving so far in and out. There's a very small chance that it's a leak or a broken enclosure or like the tube inside of there, because usually the port on the outside is attached to a tube on the inside that they use to tune that frequency. Most likely, though, you're just working it too hard for the volumes it's set at and you need to upgrade. Three thoughts on that. One, try the room placement. Two, see if there is a tuning mode on your receiver that will allow you to use its guidance for setting it. Because just in case you I don't know if you're a bass head, Rocco, you might like a lot of bass. And what seems like just the right amount of bass for you might be something in excess of the ideals that are put together when you're tuning the output from your receiver. But the guaranteed way of fixing this is to get a subwoofer that was designed to go louder and lower.
Yeah.
And that's because basically I don't think that subwoofer does much below 30 hertz. And those fight scenes in those Marvel movies that you're looking at, man, they're going low and heavy. And it starts to drop off a cliff 20, 30. It's down at least 5 dB by 30 something hertz.
You do have the calibration microphone that came with your AVR.
Start with a calibration.
Determining the level, though, the initial level to leave it set at as far as subwoofer output goes. And one nice thing about the Odyssey setups, at least, it does provide a quick run through to adjust the volume of the sub to get it into an appropriate range. However, I do find that on a lot of the older AVRs that maybe don't incorporate a direct optimizer for the sub, they're just going to do levels and everything and then adjust it accordingly. If you ever notice in the final result, if you can look at the actual numbers that are produced in terms of how it adjusted each speaker,
right.
If it's taking anything to a maximum, maybe that's a sign that you should either raise or lower it appropriately.
Yeah.
So if it's having to cut it by negative 10 units or whatever, or raise it by plus 10 units of its control for that particular speaker, or in the case of this, the sub, then maybe that's a sign the AVR is having to crank it way up in order to get the appropriate level out of it, then maybe you should ramp up the amplifier on that particular sub a little bit and then rerun it and see if it drops that number closer to the magical zero, or where it has to make less adjustment, or leaves you more headroom, I guess you could say, for a placement and adjustment. And like you said too, placement of the subwoofer can make a world of difference in terms of the perception of the audio and how it sounds within the room.
Yeah, I gotta say, this is a subwoofer with an 8-inch driver. It's got
makes me want to bust out that box.
To produce serious impact on a modern action movie, you're making that driver work awfully hard. And, you know, it's down, I found the number, it's down around 3 dB at 30 hertz. It's down 6 dB at 28 hertz.
Okay.
And there's a whole lot of audio. As Hulk is, you know, throwing whoever through whatever, or, you know.
Low frequencies.
Oh, man. I just watched Thor Ragnarok. What a fun movie. But cool. You know, you're talking about, I'm just going to say it's time to start looking at a new subwoofer.
There you go.
They started calling it the classic, you know, in later years, but there's a lot of people have gotten a lot of good mileage out of those. I would be looking at a new subwoofer.
$100 mono price.
Yeah, the $100 mono really price, or start looking at, you know, RSL or Shoe, or there's lots of good options out there. Which brings me to
Energy Take Classics were a value.
Yeah.
5.1.
Yeah.
Kit.
Yeah, they were like everybody's pick until the Pioneers Andrew Jones series came out, which was everybody's pick until Andrew Jones moved to ELAC and came out with the Debuts. Those Debuts and the Debut 2.0, which we'll be looking at soon.
There we go.
At Tim Jarre tweets, what was the program you recommended for just simple music listening on the Raspberry Pi? And there are several for you to play with. The two that come to mind, you know, first and second, or second and first, would be Volumio, which is an open source audiophile music player, and Rune Audio.
Oh, cool.
And those basically, I guess there was a group, as they do in the open source world, split up, and one individual launched Volumio and a couple other individuals launched Rune Audio. There's some familiarity going on there. They run on a staggering number of single board computers. If you know what that is, a Raspberry Pi is essentially a small, you know, cell phone sized ARM-based computer, but they've got Raspberry Pi, BeagleBone, QBox, Odroids, you know, Asus's Tinkerboard and the Sparky are supported on Volumio. But essentially what you do is you can use the audio outputs on the Raspberry Pi, which I do not recommend. I use a USB or a Raspberry Pi hat.
Or the HDMI.
Yeah, that's
right true. Into an AVR.
That would actually be a way to do it.
Go digital, baby.
I've just never connected one to my receiver, but absolutely, right? You use the, you know, I have to take a look at I'm not going to look at the HDMI audio spec off the Raspberry Pi right now, because I will go right down that rat hole and Robert will be staring at all of the tape he has to edit out. But yeah, tape. I mean, Hi-Fi Barry, yeah. Well, Hi-Fi Barry does a good Pi hat, which is sort of snaps on top of a Raspberry Pi and does the output. You can use an external DAC.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a big fan of using AudioQuest Dragonfly. Works really well with this. Yeah, check out Rune Audio, RuneAudio, or Volumio, VoLumio. And there's also a lot of good stuff going on with Rune Labs, which is RoonLabs. And it's especially enjoyable to use Rune Labs to put an interface that doesn't suck on Tidal. Or if you pine for the days of looking through LP albums, Rune Labs will basically bring some really great metadata and wrap it around your audio collection, your local audio collection. But Rune Labs, RoonLabs, is not free.
Got it.
Oh, my goodness. Here's a question you guys might be able to help us out with or add your thoughts to. Mike in Durham, North Carolina writes, love the show. Instantly made it to the top of my Pocket Cast list. Thank you, Mike. Keep up the great work. We'll do our best. He says, I've been a cord cutter for a few years now, and other than having to work around certain sports leagues' blackout restrictions to watch my hometown team, it's been as good or better than cable. However, one issue that continues to perplex me is that no set-top box, console, or smart TV OS has implemented a true universal watch list. Apple TV's TV app comes close, but from what I've seen, it doesn't support Netflix, which is my number one source for shows. Roku allows you to search universally and add shows to my feed, but only populates that feed when new content debuts, so it doesn't help me jump back into my recent shows. Of all players, Microsoft came the closest to this with the original Xbox One OS that allowed for universal search and let you add specific shows to your pins. Alas, this feature was deprecated years ago. I get why Amazon or Apple would want to downplay apps outside of their ecosystems, but I can't figure out why Roku or some other intrepid third-party developer hasn't been able to bring this very useful service to market. For me, the first OS to implement this feature wins every screen in my home. Am I missing something? Thanks, guys.
Well, when I was at CES, I did talk to Roku about the now-released OS 8. Mm-hmm. Actually, 8.1, I believe, is out now. For that updated all Roku TVs. And that did incorporate a search function. Very similar to what I felt to be something like canistream.it in terms of looking through every available source and then providing you with a list of where you could get that content that you're looking for. However, he mentions that it was more about being able to jump back into content that if it wasn't new content being debuted, it wouldn't show up in the appropriate place automatically, like right in your top menu. And that's a good question. It would be great if somebody pulls this off and gets it right, because that is quite useful just to say, You should be able to search for anything anytime, and that's kind of already available.
Yeah.
But being able to more tailor the content that you specifically want to jump in and out of quickly and easily, being able to pin that to the top, right where you want it, and to make it simple to grab and enjoy is something I understand wanting. And considering all the interface updates that I'm seeing on the new TVs coming out, I'm thinking especially with LG and Samsung, I'll be curious to see how they're managing this as well, because on the new Samsung TVs, their plug and play ability, like when you connect your cable box, it realizes it's a cable box and it figures out who your provider is and populates, you know, their latest interfaces with content. But I'm curious to see if it's offering the flexibility that Mike was looking for. And that is something I'm just going to roll into any future testing on TV interfaces, at least when I look at these devices. Take a good look in terms of how is it giving you what you want, including your favorite content. So,
your favorite content being a big deal, as ridiculous as that might sound.
Not at all. It's all good. But I understand the desire. And I do appreciate Roku's voice search, too. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised, especially for searching for a particular app. It just makes it simple for me to like, rather than type anything, just say it. It's boom, there it is. But in terms of absolute content, I tend to spend most of my world in YouTube and Netflix, mm-hmm. probably the two most used apps, and MLB.
And MLB.
Speaking of blackout restrictions.
Oh, my goodness. I'm thinking like in the last 72 hours, I've used Amazon Prime, Showtime, iTunes, Netflix, PBS Kids.
A lot of good stuff.
And a couple of Blu-rays last weekend.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to see what shows up where at what time when you're looking for it.
But, right.
If anybody has thoughts or if anybody has found something that's, you know, like the One Ring will rule them all and in the darkness bind them, let us know. I think the biggest problem with this is that it's just harder than anybody realizes to pry that data out and make it usable and put it in an interface. And, you know, I'm sure a bunch of Plex people are going to be like, Plex does this, you fools. Didn't you know that?
Please pass that information
pass
along.
Pass that information along. Neither one of us are Plex geniuses.
Not yet. I did load it up on the Roku Ultra.
Yeah.
So I will be diving into that more so.
I just want to search Netflix without wanting to punch the wall because, you know, they give me all the options I want, but none of them are available.
Yeah, I wonder if I have voice search for Netflix through the Roku. I hate typing stuff in on Netflix for some reason. I don't know why.
But. You know, I will say the microphone being added to the Apple TV remote was a game changer.
Good.
And I will say the microphone on the Amazon Fire TV stuff has gotten so much better. In the early days, it was one of the most frustrating things I experienced. Or it would guarantee, in the early days, it was particularly prone. And it's been a while since I've looked at it. It's changed. But I remember in the early days, the Fire TVs, you would be like, I want to watch X. And it would be like, you can buy X from Amazon Prime. And it's like, but it's free here and I already get it free. Or it would be free on Amazon Prime, but they would still try to get you to pay for it. And I was like, really? Really, guys? So
that does make me want to take a close look at Samsung's latest TVs too, because that was something they've worked very hard on in terms of the initial setup and then how it populates that top layer of its interface for content. And I'll do some testing before I make any comments about how what it does exactly. So,
oh my goodness,
another excuse to get more displays in.
Patreon.com/AVXL is the place to go to if you'd like to support the podcast and keep it coming. You pay us. We don't pay you.
Not yet.
Not yet. Be nice if we could pay you. Be nice if we could pay us more.
Always.
Yeah, well, I have subwoofers I covet.
We have production goals.
Production goals. Oh, my goodness. Our patrons at the $10 level will be hanging out with us hopefully next week. We appreciate each and every one of you that contributes to patreon.com/AVXL. I hopefully will have my review of the One More Triple Driver Over Ears done next week. There's another product I'm waiting to get approval to talk about before I can talk about it. We're waiting for the arrival of those new debut 2.0 speakers from ELAC.
Yes.
You're probably going to, as soon as your test equipment shows up, you're probably going to rip the packing off of
I'm going to lose a day almost immediately.
It's going to be awesome because I'll have a question for Robert and he'll disappear for like 20 hours and then he'll come back and be like, oh, sorry, missed that.
So
my calibration software
this.
Does. And there'll be this like 1,000-word screen. And I'll be like, wow.
Hey, let's do a 1,000-point 3D lookup table for a new 2018 LG OLED. Let's just do it.
Well, because he can, I'll just sit there and be supportive and stay out of the way.
Do a 1,000-point lookup table without it taking like half a day.
One last thing before we go, I meant to ask earlier. Somebody asked me, how do you do measurements on a projector? Because they understand pointing your little camera at the screen when you're calibrating a screen. How do you calibrate? Do you
point it at the
lens?
Screen.
You point it at the screen.
There are little challenges in terms of if you're dealing with
So you're several feet away from the screen. You're not like
I try to be as close as I can, but then you run into issues where you might be putting a shadow on
I was
the screen.
Say.
So it's like a balancing act of like
can you shoot at an angle?
That's the issue you can run into, depending on the gain, how reflective the screens are. The more reflective those screens tend to be, the more you get odd off-axis performance. So it's important to at least have a line of sight similar to how you would be in that room looking at the screen. Uh-huh. So all meters I'm aware of usually include some way to like mount it on a tripod so you can get it in front of the screen, because obviously you can't just like put it on the screen. It has to be back catching some of the reflected light coming off the screen. But otherwise, yeah. And it's very important to do that with projectors because every different screen out there seems to produce a slightly different response from the projector. So it's like while you may have the best projector and a great screen, if they aren't optimized for each other, you're probably not seeing the absolute best performance out of that. You very likely aren't. And it's also, too, being able to go through all the other setup options within projectors. They're the most complicated displays I work on because you're dealing with geometry, focus, convergence. And there's so many little things that need to be checked and optimized to really make those things look fantastic. And it generally is my most pleasurable, or I get the most pleasure out of working on those because the before and after is usually dramatic as can be. And it's like, wow, this looks freaking fantastic. And they generally are very good display devices. It's just that there's a lot of optimization to get them to something that's just for that particular room environment, for that particular projector and screen, to get it all nailed. It's just, I always love the after on that, and then sitting there with the client or whoever and looking at how good it can look, and it always helps. And a lot of that people can do themselves, but as far as, you know, doing white point adjustments and color management work and things like that, you do need a meter to do that stuff effectively.
But you point it at the screen, not at the lens.
Totally. Now, there are reasons you might want to just measure directly what's coming out of the projector itself without a screen involved. And that's more on the review side of things and testing. There are occasions where you would want that, but usually, 99% of the time, you're factoring in the screen and the projector together.
Got it.
By taking that measurement from the reflected light coming off the screen.
Cool.
And it's a... I highly recommend you get that done. If you love your projector and it's not going anywhere anytime soon, have it fine-tuned.
I'd like to make mine a little quieter.
Put it in a box.
Good, because, you know, heating up a projector is so much for lamp life.
Now we have to upgrade the HVAC system.
I live in a 100-year-old Craftsman home.
Portables.
There is no HVAC. Well, there's heat. There's nothing else.
We can go right over to Costco and pick up a nice LG or whoever's portable air conditioner. Those things are awesome.
Oh, yeah. Awesome is the exact word I'd use.
Awesomely expensive to run.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, Can Jam SoCal or Can Jam LA is going to be, I want to say it's at the, it's either at the JW Marriott Los Angeles. Well, it's basically at the JW Marriott Los Angeles, which is 900 West Olympic Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. It runs Saturday, April 7th and Sunday, April 8th. And let us know if you're going to be anywhere near there. I will send out tweets. And such.
Cool.
And
get your butt to L.A.
Oh, my goodness. Wouldn't be the first time. Won't be the last.
Nope. I love that city.
Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. AVXL.com is the website. Just search for AVXL on your favorite podcatcher. And if this is your first time listening to it, and I'm going to try to not say "and" one more time before I punch myself in the face or Robert
throws
his coffee mug at me.
From this episode alone, I'm going to send you all the things I cut out of it.
Oh.
Every I do it too. So it's
I've noticed there's a direct correlation between the number of times I get woken up by a sick person in the house and the number of times I say "and basically
personal rest and health is."
I'd like to apologize to each and every AVXL listener at this point.
Oh, they'll never hear this.
Oh, well, thank you, Robert. We'll see you next week on AVXL.
Take care.